Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Tonight on All In.
Did you take any classified documents with you from the White House?
I did not.
Former Vice President Pence revises his remarks a little too late to save pundit Mike Pence.
If we have a special counsel reviewing classified materials were found at Mar-a-Lago, we need to have a special counsel in this case.
Tonight, new reporting on what Pence turned over to the FBI, what it means for the investigation into his old boss and the current president.
I mean, Pence, seriously,
yeah.
We have this great thing going with Joe.
Yeah, and you just ruined it.
He did.
Come on, man.
Then are Trump world indictments coming in Georgia?
We are asking that the report not be released because you having seen that report, decisions are imminent.
What we learn from today's dramatic hearing in Fulton County, plus Senator Elizabeth Warren on the latest hostage demands in the Republican debt ceiling fight, and why on earth is America's former top diplomat excusing the brutal murder of a Washington Post columnist? But All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. I'm going to admit that I literally laughed out loud today when I looked down at my phone and saw the New York Times news alert that classified documents had been found at the home of former Trump Vice President Mike Pence. Honestly, it's starting to feel like a running bit at this point. According to a letter sent to the National Archives from Pence lawyer Greg Jacob, a, quote, small number of classified documents were inadvertently brought to Pence's home after he left the White House and were discovered after a voluntary search by outside counsel. Those documents have now been returned to the National Archives. Of course, those circumstances highlighted in that letter sound remarkably similar to the situation with President Joe Biden, who also says his team accidentally brought classified documents from his time as vice president out of the White House when he left back in 2016. Biden's team also flagged the government when the documents were discovered as part of a voluntary search and returned them to the archives. And of course, these searches are happening because of the larger Department of Justice investigation into Donald Trump's mishandling of classified and top secret documents. But of course, the circumstances there are very different. As we noted on this show from the outset of that investigation, accidentally retaining classified documents is not the issue. You never expect the best of Donald Trump, but also clearly this is not the most careful person in the world. Like, who's got the best document retention practices?
We don't know if maybe Trump threw a bunch of stuff in these boxes, didn't realize everything was there, and maybe they didn't. Maybe there was a good faith mistake here that can be explained away.
His motives to me remain opaque, and they could be the most insidious motives possible. He wanted to sell the secrets to the Saudis and the Russians, or they could be just the dumbest motives of vanity. Who knows, right? We just don't know what they are.
He would not be in criminal jeopardy at all, a former president of the United States, if when he was first contacted by the National Archives, he said, come on down. Search the place.
Yeah,
take anything you want. Just let me know what it is. And hopefully I'll get it back in from my library someday. And I look forward to working with you for my presidential library. And that's what a normal president who made a mistake would do.
Exactly, right? The thing with Trump is that after he became aware he had the classified documents, he obfuscated the truth about what he had, and he fought the National Archives, and it sure seems like he corruptly tried to obstruct the investigation. He said maybe the FBI planted the documents before pivoting to arguing the documents were his all along, justifying it all by saying that maybe he had actually magically, retroactively declassified all the documents without telling anyone, or that he might have just kept the material as I have to quote him here, cool keepsake. So that's the clear difference between what Trump did and what Mike Pence and Joe Biden did. And that difference did make it very funny today when Trump jumped to Pence's defense on his knockoff Twitter platform, posting, quote, Mike Pence is an innocent man. He never did anything knowingly dishonest in his life. Leave him alone. Not exactly the messenger Pence wants in his corner today, although to be fair, Mike Pence from 2 months ago isn't doing himself any favors either.
Did you take any classified documents with you from the White House?
I did not.
Do you see any reason for anyone to take classified documents with them leaving the White House?
Well, there'd be no reason to have classified documents, particularly if they were in an unprotected area.
An unprotected area like, I don't know, big old house in Indiana? Now, again, no one's suggesting Pence did this intentionally. It was presumably an accident during the haphazard shuffle of leaving the White House, which incidentally is the same thing that likely happened with President Biden and even possibly Trump. Fair is fair. When the Trump document investigation escalated, Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel. When the Biden documents were revealed, Garland appointed another special counsel to investigate Biden. So now that Mike Pence has revealed classified documents under very similar circumstances, shouldn't Garland appoint a third special counsel? Let's ask Mike Pence.
I welcome the decision by Attorney General Garland to appoint a special counsel. If we have a special counsel reviewing classified materials that were found at Mar-a-Lago, we need to have a special counsel in this case, and that's progress. The handling of classified materials in the nation's secret is a very serious matter. As a former vice president of the United States, I can speak from personal experience about the attention that ought to be paid to those materials when you're in office and after you leave office. And clearly, that did not take place in this case.
Okay, credit where due. Gotta say, Mike Pence makes a pretty compelling case for appointing a special counsel to investigate Mike Pence. He's not the only one. Today, Congressman Don Bacon, Republican in Nebraska, said he supports a special counsel to investigate Pence as well.
Do you think that Merrick Garland should appoint a third special counsel to look into how classified material wound up at the Indiana home of former Vice President Mike Pence?
I think Americans want fairness here. You treat one like you treat the other. That's why Joe Biden now has a special counsel. And I think we're going to have another one here for Vice President Pence.
Okay, so that's a yes. You would support a third special counsel.
Now, I'm not a lawyer, but from where I'm standing, from what I've read, from what the reporting suggests, doesn't seem very likely the Justice Department would charge Biden or Pence. They found the documents voluntarily. They flagged the National Archives when they did, as well as the FBI. I think most people agree taking the documents was probably just a mistake, especially considering the government's track record of over-classifying information. In fact, announcing it's plausible that, I don't know, every living president and vice president might accidentally have classified documents in their possession. I wouldn't be surprised if you got that news alert tomorrow. Now, of course, the difference here is how they respond. That's what Trump did wrong over and over. He took the documents containing some of our nation's most closely guarded secrets. He refused to give them back. He fought the investigators. His lawyers misled the government of what he had. The FBI counterintelligence chief flew down to Mar-a-Lago to be like, please, bro, dude, please, just hand him over. No luck. It is the same corrupt intent and seemingly compulsive lawlessness that permeated Trump's entire tenure in American government. That's the difference. Jamil Jaffer is the executive director of the Knight First Amendment Institute, Columbia University, as well as the executive editor of Just Security, which I read basically every day. And he joins me now. Good to have you here.
Thanks for the invitation.
How would you assess these three stories now?
I think there are obvious differences between Trump and Biden. I don't think we know enough yet about the Pence story, but obvious differences between Trump and Biden, including the ones you already mentioned. It seems, from what we know, Biden retained these documents inadvertently, I would say maybe recklessly, but he did cooperate with the Justice Department right away. He didn't lie about it. Trump, on the other hand, retained all these things, lied about it, interfered with the Justice Department's investigation. So totally different worlds. I do think that I don't want to make excuses for either one of them, but I do think that there is something bigger going on here. And that's that the secrecy system, the classification system, is totally broken. There's way too much information that is classified. A lot of what's classified is classified for the wrong reasons. It's classified because disclosure would embarrass somebody or it would be inconvenient for the government, not because its disclosure would jeopardize national security. Too many people have access to classified secrets. There are 5 million people in the United States who have security clearance, which is a crazy number, right?
It's five, because we have, this is from 2017 that DNI put on that put the number at like three then.
I think it's almost five now, including contractors.
Which is more than 1% of Americans, like one out of 100 Americans.
It is a staggering number of people who have access to these secrets, and it's not surprising given how much is classified. And how many people have access to the secrets that the national security bureaucracy just can't keep track. And that's a terrible thing for national security. It's a terrible thing for public debate about issues that really matter, like war and foreign policy and counterterrorism, national security, all of those things. Debate about all those things gets distorted by overclassification.
You know, that point, this has been one of the most interesting things of watching this all develop. I think at some point we had someone on the program, and I said, well, Is it like a library, right? Like if you keep a library book, the library knows you have the book because there's a system whereby it's checked out, right? And libraries will follow you to the ends of the earth often. Sorry, Brown University. I think there's still a few in my bookshelves. But you know, there's nothing like that as far as we can tell. I remember asking someone like, shouldn't there be some record?
Yeah,
particularly pertaining. Right. I mean, one of the points you make here is like there's classified and there's really classified, right? So there's this huge system. It does seem like some of the Trump stuff was really like way up that chain of very secret.
Well, that's true.
But you would also think there would be a record of that.
Yes, you would think there'd be a record. It's also true. I mean, maybe the stuff Trump had was very, very secret, or maybe it was very, very secret at the time he took it,
right,
but the secrets became stale later on. The thing is, one consequence of the broken classification system is that the mere fact that something is classified doesn't actually tell you very much about whether its disclosure would cause harm. And that's true even if it's top secret. There's all sorts of stuff that's classified at the highest levels that shouldn't be classified. Maybe it should have been classified at one point, but it shouldn't be classified anymore.
I want to play what Lindsey Graham had said today, which was sort of along these lines. Take a listen.
You got Trump, you got Pence, you got Biden. The only thing I think you'll find at my house is a bunch of Chick-fil-A bags on the floor. The bottom line is I don't know how this happened. We need to get to the bottom of it. I don't believe for a minute that Mike Pence is trying to intentionally compromise national security. I think that about Biden and Trump, but clearly we've got a problem here. So hopefully when this is all said and done, maybe we're overclassifying things. That may be part of the problem, but count me in for getting this fixed.
I mean, maybe you and Senator Graham could team up here.
Yeah, I would love to talk to him. I mean, I think that there's a danger in thinking everybody does it. It may be true at the highest levels of government that it is common for the most senior officials to be reckless with classified information. I don't know.
Well, we should also say these are the highest. I mean, these are the most special case, right? President, vice president.
That's true.
Are
yes.
people with enormous files that actually have to like move very quickly at a date
that's
certain
true.
Set by the Constitution to get everything, you know, moved
yeah,
around.
That's so. True. Still, I would have expected them to be more careful than they've been. And if you look at, you know, it's not true that lower level people are this careless with secrets. To the contrary, if you are a low-level employee at the DOD or the CIA, you are very, very careful. And you're very careful because you know that a single misstep will cost you at the very least your security clearance, which is your livelihood, and maybe get charged. And we've seen it over and over again. The senior officials are treated with kid gloves, and lower-level people, even when they're sharing secrets in order to inform the public about grave abuses of power, you know, they're prosecuted to the full extent of the law. So there is that kind of double standard
that
always has been.
I saw Reality Winner, who was sort of, you know, took, I think, two documents, sent them to reporters to basically confirm that indeed Russia had attempted to interfere in the election. It wasn't sources and methods. It was basically confirming what had been publicly reported and indicated.
And sentenced to 5 years.
5 years, the longest term ever, I think, for someone for what she was convicted. She was tweeting today with a kind of like side eye when people were saying, well, there should be one standard for everyone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a little bit indefensible that when people disclose information with good motives in order to inform the public about abuses of power or government criminality or fraud, you know, we throw the book at them. But when senior officials, I mean, you remember the Petraeus case, when General Petraeus disclosed top secret code word information to his biographer, He was charged with a misdemeanor.
I gotta say, if you went back in time machine, I would not think that document retention practices would play quite the central dramatic role they've played in American politics from 2015 on. But here we are, Jamil Jaffer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Georgia prosecutor investigating Donald Trump says decisions are imminent. Her words. Today's big hearing, what we could learn soon, next.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more that we have, because we won the state.
It's been just over 2 years since Donald Trump was recorded pressuring the Georgia Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn the state's 2020 presidential election results. And now decisions on whether to charge him or anyone else with election interference in Georgia are, quote, imminent. In Atlanta today, a judge heard arguments on whether to publicly release the final report of a special grand jury that spent months investigating Trump and his allies. On one side, a group of media organizations who want the report released immediately.
The jurors themselves have asked for it to be published. There's enormous public interest in what they have said, and that exists in this state. It exists across the nation. It exists beyond the nation.
On the other side, Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis, who convened the special grand jury and who wants the report sealed until she makes a decision on criminal charges.
At this time, in the interest of justice and the rights of not the state but others, we are asking that the report not be released, because you having seen that report, decisions are imminent.
You having seen that report, decisions are imminent, she says. The judge hasn't made a ruling yet, but someone who is in that courtroom today, Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent at Yahoo News, joins me now. Michael, give us a little sense of what the arguments were and what it was like in that courtroom today.
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating. Look, the headline was that Fani Willis, the district attorney, was asking that the report not be immediately released. But the language she used was quite telling. She said, you showed some of it there, but she talked about the rights of future defendants. Mm-hmm. And when I listened to that, to me, that was the strongest indication we've had yet directly from Fani Willis that she's planning on indictments, because there won't be future defendants unless she indicts somebody. So it was, although a lot of us were hoping to see this report, we've been following it for months now. They've been calling witnesses, by the way, witnesses who never, some of whom never appeared before the January 6th committee. Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, was forced to testify before this Fulton County grand jury. Lindsey Graham, who also called Brad Raffensperger and pressured him on changing election results, or talked to him about it at least, he also testified. These are witnesses whose testimony we've never seen. That didn't appear before January 6th committee. So there's a lot of expectation about this report, a lot of anticipation about it. It's clear. And by the way, one other point, the judge, Judge McBurney, who's overseeing this investigation, seems to want to put out something, some form of the report, perhaps with redactions on the recommendations, but at least on the fact gathering. And so we're going to have to wait and see. But I think we should hear from McBurney fairly soon on this.
Yeah, your point there is well taken, right? Because the subpoena power here is the just normal criminal subpoena power of any jurisdiction in the country, saying, hey, we're investigating this and you're subpoenaed. And a bunch of folks, Graham, Meadows, Giuliani and others, tried to go to court to say, you can't compel our testimony, and we're unsuccessful. So, you know, you've got these witnesses that were compelled to testify, as you note in your write-up of this. And then, of course, there's the fact that there's tremendous public interest here, hence the consortium. It's been previously reported nearly 20 people known to have been named as targets of the investigation, which means they've been notified by the Fulton County DA's office that they are targets, right? Including Rudy Giuliani, Mr. Trump's former personal lawyer. So this is fairly mature. It's also a strange process here that this report exists, and it seems like the jury itself voted to release it.
Yes, that was something that was new. Judge McBurney said that the grand jurors had told him in some form, we're not exactly clear, that they wanted the release of this report, of their report. And I should point out, you know, everybody's been focused for 2 years now on the Raffensperger phone call. And that was, you know, clearly eye-grabbing to a lot of people. You know, Trump talks about how Raffensperger could face criminal penalties if he doesn't find the votes that Trump needs. But it's not just the Raffensperger phone call. There's the Giuliani testimony where he goes before the state legislative committees and makes all these outrageous claims about the Fulton County, the suitcases of ballots being brought in by the two, by Ruby Freeman and her daughter, and they were passing them along like drug dealers, all of which, you know, none of which has ever been substantiated. The FBI looked at it. The GBI looked at it. They found nothing to it. So false testimony by Giuliani, and then also the fake elector scheme on December 14th. You know, the Georgia Republican chairman, David Schaefer, convenes these 16 electors who vote to anoint themselves the duly elected electors from the state of Georgia. So the expectation is Willis is looking at this as a conspiracy case, a racketeering conspiracy case under Georgia law, and that will allow her to tell the full story to the jury.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And there's public reporting indicating that there have been subpoenas issued to the folks involved in the fake elector case. We should also note that if you're looking for chargeable crimes, right, there's an attestation they sign saying we are the duly elected electors. We certify hereby that we are, that is just exists in black and white, that's there. Michael Isikoff, who was in that courtroom today, I continue to think this remains one of the most fascinating sort of shoes yet to drop. We will keep our eyes on it. Thank you for your time tonight. Still ahead, Republicans holding the U.S. economy hostage set their sights on, you guessed it, Social Security, Medicare. Senator Elizabeth Warren joins me on what Democrats need to do to stand their ground. Next. The new House Republican caucus is determined to hold some sort of hostage standoff with the debt ceiling, where they just threaten all of us, the economy, the full faith and credit of the U.S., a huge financial catastrophe, in order to slash government programs. That's what they say they want. Of course, when you ask them what cuts they want, they tend to get nonspecific on the details, though I think we all have our suspicions. Remember, last year, in the lead up to the midterm election, Florida Republican Senator Rick Scott unveiled a new conservative policy plan for the Republicans running to take the Senate, which would sunset all federal legislation, including Social Security and Medicare, within 5 years. Back then, Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, who has sounder political instincts, strenuously denied this was part of the Republican agenda, was mad at Scott for releasing it. Fast forward today, and you'll never guess what House Republicans are thinking of going after now. New reporting from the Washington Post says that House Republicans are considering slashing Social Security and Medicare as part of the debt ceiling fight. Quote, a group of GOP lawmakers has called for the creation of special panels that might recommend changes to Social Security and Medicare. Others in the party have resurfaced more detailed plans to cut costs, including by raising the Social Security retirement age to 70, targeting younger Americans who have yet to obtain federal benefits. Senator Elizabeth Warren is a Democrat of Massachusetts. She just wrote an op-ed for the Boston Globe on the Republican debt ceiling con game, and she joins me now. As a Democratic senator, I can imagine you and the rest of your colleagues are just terrified at the political prospect of Republicans proposing raising the retirement age to 70 and having to go out there and argue to the American people this is a bad idea.
No, not terrified, furious, right? We are ready to go on this. But, you know, that really is the heart of it. You've got it exactly right. This is about the Republican vision of who should pay to make this country run versus the Democratic vision. So the Republicans are saying right now, cut benefits, cut spending, drag the economy down, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, put all of that on the table in order to do what? In order to protect the tax breaks for the richest Americans. Because the Republicans are not serious about the national debt. And you know how I know that? One is they raised the debt ceiling three times while Donald Trump was president. No muss, no fuss, just got it done.
Yep.
But now that they have been elected in the House and in control, the first bill they pass is one that would actually raise the debt ceiling, raise the debt, rather, the national debt, bump into the debt ceiling even harder. And in order to do what? In order to protect millionaire and billionaire tax cheats. They want to reduce even more the likelihood those guys are going to be audited. And then the second thing that they're about to ram through, and they say they're going to do a vote on it, is a 30% nationwide sales tax. Think about that. 30% increase in what it takes to buy groceries, to pay your rent, to buy diapers, to pay for gasoline, car payments, name it all. That's what the Republicans want to do. But here's the deal. What we say as Democrats is, look, we're not going to talk about spending cuts so long as you guys are out here just talking about how to protect the billionaires and the giant corporations. We got a lot of things we could do to stitch up those loopholes, like repeal the Trump tax cuts, do ban the places, tax havens that giant corporations go to, stitch up a loophole that got kicked in the 15% corporate minimum tax. We could create about $1.7 trillion right there. But the Republicans don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about making hardworking families, middle-class families, bear more burden and let the wealthiest and the most well-connected get off with even less. That's just not right.
You know, you can sort of see, I should note that Kevin McCarthy today said he does not favor the proposed Buddy Carter legislation, which has apparently been promised regular order as part of those speaker negotiations. It's unclear if it's going to get a floor vote. It looks like it's going to get a committee vote. He understands that this is terrible politics, and I think running away from it, they're going to try to bottle up in committee. I also think generally McConnell is savvier on this. You saw what he did with Rick Scott, right, during the election. When Rick Scott said this, McConnell was like, no, never. Of course not. Now, today, I want to get your reaction. This is very interesting. He's basically saying, I wish McCarthy well. Like, don't look at me. I don't have anything to do with this. You guys figure it out. This is what he said about the debt ceiling negotiation. Take a listen.
I can't imagine any kind of debt ceiling measure that could pass the Senate would also pass the House. I think it's entirely reasonable for the new Speaker and his team to put spending reduction on the table. I wish him well, and talking to the President, that's where a solution lies.
What do you make of that?
So look, the Republicans have run this play before. This is no surprise. It did back in 2011. And they said, we're going to hold the entire nation's economy hostage, the worldwide economy, by not raising the debt ceiling unless you agree to across-the-board spending cuts. What that really turned out to mean is that we were trying to come out of a recession, and it meant we had higher unemployment. We held back the economy. Working families were the ones who bore the burden. And that was where the economy was as we rolled into the 2016 election that resulted in Donald Trump going to the White House. Now, right now, just fast forward 4 years past that, Joe Biden is sitting on a strong economy that has started to work for middle-class families, for working families, and for the Republicans, particularly for Donald Trump. That is a political problem for them. Donald Trump himself has said the reason the red wave didn't occur was that Americans weren't feeling enough pain. But if they can push enough pain on American families over the next 2 years, they believe it will help Republicans and in particular help put Donald Trump in the White House. Democrats are not going to fall for this again.
Well, this segues to an issue that I know is near and dear to your heart and to mine as well, which is what the Fed does.
Yes.
If you look at the measurements, there is a steep deceleration in inflation. There's other measures that show that's lagging. And there's this question of, like, will the Fed take yes for an answer, or are they determined to produce a recession? It's probably the most important political and economic question in the country right now. And are you at all hopeful, Christopher Waller, who's a Fed governor, sounding a little more less hawkish that they're getting the message here?
Well, you know, the data very much back up the idea that inflation is easing. I get it. We want to bring down the inflation rate, but that means landing the plane, not crashing
Yep.
the plane. We don't need more of these gigantic increases in the interest rates. And I would just say, as I've said so many times to the Federal Reserve chair, remember, you have a dual mandate. And the dual mandate, yes, is to make sure that we keep inflation under control, but it's also for employment, to keep people around this country employed. I keep trying to remind him that what is worse than inflation and low employment, it's inflation and high unemployment. So I very much hope that we will not see more interest rate increases, certainly at the levels that we've seen them in the past, and that the Fed, as you rightly say, will take yes for an answer.
Yeah.
We're getting inflation under control. Let's land this plane smoothly for hardworking families all across this country.
Land the plane, Jerome. I'm going to get T-shirts made up. Senator Elizabeth Warren, thank you very much. Still to come, Mike Pompeo prepares to launch a presidential campaign by trashing a murdered journalist. Why Pompeo's callous comments are just part of a larger Republican trend ahead. You know, in the wake of the 2016 election, I think there was this broad feeling of dejection that, well, nothing matters, that somehow Donald Trump had defied political gravity and all the conventional wisdom about campaigning, about winning over swing voters, about not being a complete ludicrous ego monster jerk. But then, well, we've had the 2018 midterms and Trump's unsuccessful bid for re-election 2020 and the deeply unimpressive results for Republicans in last year's midterms. And I think all of that has taught us that, well, actually, gravity does exist. You know, all those things, how you run a campaign, policy positions, candidate quality, whether people see you as extreme, they do matter. Republicans are, however, refusing to learn that lesson. Even after this incredibly disappointing midterm result, Speaker Kevin McCarthy and the House Republican caucus are operating on that same old nothing matters premise. See a clear example of that in the way McCarthy is behaving about committee assignments. He and his caucus, Marjorie Taylor Greene, among others, want revenge against the Democrats for the removal of two of his members, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, from their committee assignments in 2021. That came after Greene and Gosar both used violent rhetoric against their Democratic colleagues. So McCarthy chose three Democrats who've done absolutely nothing wrong and began threatening to kick them off their committees if the Republicans won. All that Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, and Ilhan Omar are guilty of is really being targets of Republican ire. Now, McCarthy does have the authority to unilaterally keep Schiff and Swalwell off the Intelligence Committee. The Speaker has that veto power over what's called select committees, which the Intelligence Committee is. But Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries implored McCarthy not to do it. In a letter to McCarthy, Jeffries pointed out the double standard of Republicans appointing serial fraudster George Santos to two standing committees. And he made sure to remind McCarthy that Greene and Gosar were removed after a bipartisan vote of the House found them unfit to serve. Well, just moments ago, we got word that McCarthy's doing it anyway, formally rejecting the appointments of Schiff and Swalwell to the Intelligence Committee. Tonight, he told reporters that he's doing it to put national security first.
Those members will have other committees, but the Intel Committee is different. Hakeem Jeffrey has 200 other people who can serve on that committee. This is the right of the Speaker, and the one thing I will always do, I will put the national security ahead of partisan politics any day. I don't care if they're in my party or not. Integrity matters.
Okay, I don't care if they're in my party or not. Integrity matters is a funny bit from a guy who has George Santos in his caucus. Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, and Ilhan Omar released a joint statement in the wake of this news, calling it, quote, disappointing but not surprising that Kevin McCarthy has capitulated to the right wing of his caucus, undermining the integrity of the Congress and harming our national security in the process. But McCarthy can't get his way so easily with all the committees. He needs to win a full House vote on the floor to remove Ilhan Omar from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Punchbowl News reports that Jeffries is going to force the issue by formally naming Omar to the committee this week. Now, we know how hard a full House vote can be with this narrow Republican majority. It took them 4 days and 15 votes just to pick a speaker. And on the Ilhan Omar issue, there are already two Republican defectors. Victoria Spartz of Indiana now joins Nancy Mace of South Carolina as a no vote on ousting Omar from her committee. In a statement, Spartz blasted the leader of her party, writing, quote, two wrongs do not make a right. I will not support this charade again. Speaker McCarthy needs to stop bread and circuses in Congress and start governing for a change. You have to wonder how many times a Republican speaker will have to learn the lesson that political gravity does exist for him and his party. There are 18 members of his caucus who represent districts that President Biden won in 2020. The constituents of those 18 members and other members like Victoria Spartz and Nancy Mace and others may not want Ilhan Omar voted off her committee. And they probably do not want Republicans playing chicken with the debt ceiling or banning migrants from making asylum claims. So everyone who does not want those extreme policies and wants to avoid catastrophe under this Republican House majority needs to keep reminding them of that. I have to say personally that I did not think Mike Pompeo could sink any lower, but he has now surpassed my already low expectations of him. In his book released today, Donald Trump's ex-Secretary of State has this to say about murdered human rights activist and journalist Jamal Khashoggi, quote, he didn't deserve to die, but we need to be clear about who he was. And too many in the media were not. Mocking what he called the media portrayal of Khashoggi as, quote, a Saudi Arabian Bob Woodward who was martyred for bravely criticizing the Saudi royal family through his opinion articles. Pompeo insists Khashoggi was, quote, an activist, claiming he was a journalist only, quote, to the extent that I and many other public figures are journalists. We sometimes get our writing published, but we also do other things. Fred Ryan, the publisher of the Washington Post, where Khashoggi was a columnist, released a statement saying in part, quote, Jamal was brutally murdered on the orders of the Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman. His only offense was exposing corruption and oppression among those in power, work that good journalists around the world do every day. I'm joined now by Peter Beinhart, author of The Beinhart Notebook on Substack, focused on American foreign policy. We should note that, like, Mike Pompeo, I think, wanted to pick some fights to get attention for his book, and I look forward to him getting 1 or 2% if he lasts until New Hampshire, which I think is unlikely. So this is all coming from that, but it's really despicable.
Yeah, and it is. And it really is telling about Pompeo, because one of the things you have to remember about Pompeo, he was one of the biggest anti-Muslim bigots in Congress. In 2013, after the Boston Marathon bombing, he basically accused Muslim leaders across the country of being complicit, lied and said they hadn't disavowed it. So what does that have to do with this? What he says in about Khashoggi is, I know enough about the Middle East to know that this kind of thing is routine in the Middle East. That's what he said, right? So the implication is, this is what Muslims and Arabs do, right? But actually, it was one particular regime and one particular man who did this. And you know who flacked for that regime and that man? Mike Pompeo. When Congress froze arms sales to Saudi Arabia after Khashoggi's death, Pompeo invoked an emergency saying that we had to sell them $8 billion because it was a national security emergency. So he's essentially upset at Khashoggi because Khashoggi wasn't willing to buckle under to the Saudis like he was.
That's a great point. And we should note here, of course, that the Biden administration has hardly covered itself in glory on the relationship with Saudi Arabia. There was the notorious fist bump, the kind of harsh rhetoric, which then gives way to real politique because gas prices are high and then you're going to visit him. And it's the same thing we've seen a million times.
Yes.
But the level of supplicants of Mike Pompeo, the American firsters, Kushner, Trump, Mike Pompeo, to the Saudis was unlike anything I've ever seen in my career coming foreign policy.
No, and they've been paid handsomely for it, right? The Saudi golf course is at Trump's golf course. Kushner gets $2 billion in his investment fund, despite the fact that he has no capacity to actually make anybody any money. And these are down payments, because if this crowd, Kushner, Pompeo, Trump, get back into office, they will have prepaid them for the insurance that the Saudis will be kept away from any impunity in the future.
There's also something really gross about this. You know, he's today on Twitter calling him a part-time stringer for WAPO. I know. It's really you know, Donald Trump's whole thing where he, you know, points around at the, you know, to the cameras and the crowd all jeers, and the camera equipment at January 6th, where people had their cameras smashed and burned, right? That this idea, it's a very close leap from that to, like, well, this Jamal Khashoggi guy is kind of a troublemaker. Like, you know how you feel about the media. maybe there's some people in Saudi who feel that way too.
Right.
Like that's a subtext of this whole thing.
Right. And also, he's only an opinion journalist. He's not, as if the Trump administration had so much respect for other kinds of journalists, right? That they have been hostile to press freedom across the board, right? And for Pompeo to suggest that he's somehow equivalent to Mike Pompeo because his press secretary wrote him an op-ed now and then, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Where do you think that, what do you think this says about what this primary will look like on foreign policy?
I think
in the Republican Party.
What this primary is going to look like on the Republican foreign policy is going to be a McCarthyism on China with very thinly veiled attacks on Chinese and other Asian Americans as a fifth column of a kind that we really probably have not seen since the 1950s.
It's a great point because, one of the other parts of the book, right, is Pompeo bragging that he was criticizing China and Donald Trump told him to shut up, trying to get to Trump's right. And there's going to be a run to the most demagogic, grossest stuff on China in this primary.
Right. And they'll say it's because they care so much about human rights in China. Well, not so much in Saudi Arabia, it turns out. They don't care very much about human rights.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like the greatest test of all time, right? Like this very clear, transparent thing happens. It happens in another country's embassy, which, by the way, Turkey was not super psyched about, as one would imagine. The guy is an American resident. He writes for an American newspaper.
Right.
It's like the perfect experiment to test whether you actually mean anything you say in all of your rhetoric about freedom and liberty and tyranny abroad.
Right. But this has always been the longstanding thing with American conservatives. They care a lot about human rights in countries where America has very little influence because they're America's enemies. When it comes to America's own practices and the practices of governments that we arm, they care a lot less.
Yeah. And I have to say, I am sorry to say as an American liberal myself that I'm not sure how well liberals do on that test as well.
No, there's a lot.
Particularly when it comes
not nearly enough
when it comes to the Middle East. I guess, in the end, I think to myself, who is Mike Pompeo for? Who is the Mike Pompeo campaign for? And the answer is no one. I mean, I guess he would get Mohammed bin Salman's vote, but I can't imagine.
He's not even going to get a show on Fox News.
No.
You know, nothing.
Peter Beinart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.